I have a great pleasure to introduce Mr. Ramaswamy. He is a native of southwestern Ohio, the son of Indian parents. He graduated from Harvard summa cum laude in biology. That was my major as well. And in 2007, after graduation, he went to work in the healthcare and biotech industries and then graduated from Yale Law School in 2013. He founded the biotech company Roivant in 2014 and launched the largest biotech IPOs in 2015 and 2016. But in 2020, he left his company and has become a leading figure in advocating for stakeholder capitalism and free speech. He's left a company that developed a prostate cancer drug, and now he spends his time fighting a pernicious cancer, which can be called woke culture. Mr. Ramaswamy is the author of Woke Inc., Inside Corporate America's Social Justice Scam. Again, it is my great pleasure to introduce Mr. Ramaswamy. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. I've never been to Jefferson City before, but it's a city that I, you know, better late than never in making it to. So thank you for having me. So look, I know we have a pretty legally sophisticated audience here, so I'll kind of leave a lot of the introductory material to one side. I'm going to tell you at the end, I'm going to preview this right now, is I'm going to ask actually for some help from all of you in a new direction that I think is actually going to be useful in fighting the, you know, fighting for the agenda that I think many of us care about here, but in ways that go outside of the law and through the front door of the market to actually address a revival of an aspect of American culture that I think we're all circling around, even on that last panel, with debates that ultimately have trade-offs with how we address them through law and public policy, but may actually be more parsimoniously addressed through the market, which is actually a place that I've landed myself in the last 6 months of the journey that you just heard described in that introduction. That being said, let me talk a little bit about the focus of what I've been writing about over the course of the last year, and then lay out what I view as, I think, a better way forward to address the cultural issues at the core of this new woke epidemic. I think that one of the things they teach you in biology is that in order to understand the root causes of a cancer, to understand a cancer, you have to first understand the root causes of that cancer. And I think the root causes of the modern secular religion, which says that your identity is based on your race, your gender, and your sexual orientation, actually traces its origins not to the 21st century, where we've seen this perpetuate itself in our schools and other aspects of our culture, but rather through to the 20th century, to the two most toxic ideologies of the 1900s. And to me, those began on the other side of the Atlantic. Those were the philosophies of German Nazism, which was identity politics on steroids, and Soviet Marxism, which was an oppressed narrative on steroids. You combine the two, and you get their modern love child, as I call it, of wokeism here on American soil. And this is a new secular religion in our country whose belief system centers on the idea that your identity is based on your race, your gender, and your sexual orientation, that if you're black, you're inherently disadvantaged, that if you're white, you're inherently privileged. Crucially, no matter your economic background or your upbringing, that's where it parts ways with 20th century Marxism, your race and your gender is what govern who you are and the thoughts and ideas you're allowed to have. And I think it's really important that we look at this new philosophy with clear eyes that don't put words in the other side's mouth, but really take the other side at their own word for what this new ideology represents. And so I wrote this book, Woke Inc., last year that went on to be a New York Times bestseller or something like this. There was a much more successful book than mine, a much more successful New York Times bestseller, by the name of How to Be an Anti-Racist, authored by Ibram Kendi. And early in his book, he lays out what's really the core thesis of the book, the idea that the remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination, that the remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. Agree or not, that's what the anti-racist movement claims as a core tenet of what it actually stands for today. So at least we can understand what the claim is before we debate it. Or the claims of Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, a member of the squad in Congress, who famously said that we don't want any more black faces that don't want to be a black voice, that we don't want any more brown faces that don't want to be a brown voice, full stop. Again, agree or not, we can first understand the essence of the claim before actually debating its merits. And I think embedded in that new worldview is an intellectual move that's really interesting. And I think it's one that we ought to see with clear eyes. It says that your race, your racial identity, is no longer about the color of your skin, about your melanin count, but it's about the content of the thoughts and ideas that you're allowed to have. And this isn't just an accident of an Ayanna Pressley quote. I think it's a core tenet of the new postmodern identity movement. Actually, there was a famous protest to Peter Thiel's speech at the RNC a few years ago, saying that it was offensive to call Peter Thiel gay just because he happened to be attracted to men, and he was a man who was attracted to men, because gay meant more than who you were attracted to on the basis of your sexual orientation. It was a political identity that stood for the content of the views that you were supposed to espouse, and so forth. And so that's actually what rests at the heart of this new ideology, is conflating the characteristics that you inherit on the day that you're born with the content of the viewpoints that you're ultimately allowed to have. And I think that lies at the heart of what makes dissent so difficult in this new cultural environment, because we also live in a moment where there is no greater damnation than to be called a racist. So if your race is no longer about your skin color, but represents the content of your political beliefs, then by definition, any disagreement with those political beliefs leaves you vulnerable to the allegation of racism. And because there is no greater damnation than to be called a racist, that puts a lot of everyday Americans in the position of having to choose between bending the knee to that new religion or being tarred with the scarlet R. And when faced with that choice, everyday Americans are choosing to bend the knee. And I think that's what's created the greatest threat to our culture of free speech. It's not a legal assault on free speech, the kind of thing our founding fathers may have been concerned about 2.5 centuries ago. It is a cultural threat to the culture of free speech in our country, where a new culture of fear has eroded the norm of free speech in our country, whereby in the name of diversity, we've actually completely sacrificed true diversity of thought. In the name of inclusion, we've created an exclusionary culture where certain points of view just aren't welcome. In the name of democracy, we've actually eroded the very democratic norms of free speech and open debate that define what it means to be living in a worthy democracy. Actually, one of the things, if you ask me about the best measure of the health of any democracy, it actually isn't the number of ballots that are cast every November. That's just fetishizing the final act at the end of the process. It is the percentage of people who actually feel free to express their true beliefs in public. And to me, there's no doubt that on that metric, we're doing abysmally today. There's data to back it up. In fact, there's a recent survey conducted by the Cato Institute, which found that over 60% of Americans, that included Republicans, Democrats, and independents in the survey, 6 out of 10 of them said that they were afraid of expressing their true beliefs in public because of the current political environment. Personally, I can't remember a time in my life as an American born 36 years ago where there was a greater difference between what people were willing to express in private and what people were willing to say publicly. And to me, that is not America. That is not the country, certainly, that my parents came halfway across the world to join. It isn't the country that we want to see America become. But there's a challenge in all of this for groups like those of us in this room that have public policy available to us as a vehicle to drive the kind of cultural and social change for the better that has brought us to where we are, but addressing threats that are fundamentally cultural rather than legal in their origin, at least in the first order. And that's kind of the dilemma that I'm going to spend the balance of the hour talking about. And before I get there, I think it's worth tracing the history. I heard the last panel of how some of these culturally oppressive philosophies, I think it's fair to call them culturally oppressive philosophies, went from being fringe theories in the academy, in the halls of a liberal arts university. What it was that caused those ideas to transcend the boundaries of academia to to actually become mainstream in modern political discourse. Wokeness, when it was born, was about fundamentally challenging prevailing orthodoxies. Derrick Bell, as a critical race theorist, was challenging a prevailing orthodoxy. And agree or not, there's something about that that actually can respect, about somebody who's willing to stand up to the system of their era. But the story that's more interesting today is when this new narrative of critical theory went from being about challenging the system to actually quietly becoming the system. And because part of the solutions I'm going to talk about actually relate to solutions that drive their way through the market, I'm actually going to trace one of the origin stories that begins in the market as well, that dates back to the 2008 financial crisis. So the 2008 financial crisis, you know, most of you may remember it. I remembered it because my first job was in New York City in 2007 on the eve of the 08 crisis. Back after the 08 crisis, we lived in a moment where big business had just gone in this country from being viewed as the bad guys, or being viewed as the guys who brought prosperity, to then being viewed as the bad guys in the back of the 08 financial crisis. And, you know, for good reason, in some measure. I think that we can debate the policies of government-fueled bailouts, but ultimately, what we had was a period of time where a lot of bankers made a lot of money when time was good, and then they went to ultimately getting bailed out at the public fisc when times went bad. So understandably, a lot of people on the left, and even a lot of people on the right, myself included, had some issues with that instantiation of capitalism, which was really just another form of crony capitalism in disguise. So what happened was you had the Occupy Wall Street movement that was born that had a new demand that said that actually this system is broken. The thing that we need to do is to take money from all those wealthy corporate fat cats and redistribute it to poor people to help poor people. Agree or not, that is what the old left had to say. But there was the birth of this new woke left right around the same time that had a slightly different theory of the case. They said that actually the real problem wasn't quite economic injustice, as I alluded to earlier. No, it was racial injustice and misogyny and bigotry. And my view is that actually presented the opportunity of a generation for big business in this country to go from being the bad guys in the moment to actually becoming the good guys if they simply said the right things. Applaud diversity and inclusion. Put some token minorities on your boards. Muse about the racially disparate impact of climate change after you fly in a private jet to Davos. This is actually pretty good work if you can get it. But crucially, they didn't do it for free. They were happy to lend their money and lend, more importantly, their legitimacy to this new set of ideas. But they didn't do it for free. Their effective demand in return was that the new left look the other way when it came to leaving their own corporate power structures intact, because the old left was actually the biggest political threat to, let's just say, banking institutions in this country from the political perspective. But now, if the old left agreed to look the other way, that would ultimately be a grand bargain, a sort of Faustian bargain for each party, an arranged marriage for two parties that didn't necessarily love each other. They might have mutually disdained one another, but they were able to each get something out of the trade. That's how this new trend of so-called woke capitalism was born. A bunch of big banks got in bed with a bunch of woke millennials. Together, they birthed woke capitalism, and they used that to put Occupy Wall Street up for adoption. And that trade worked sufficiently well that other segments of the American business class started to get in on the act. I think Silicon Valley followed suit, where, again, they recognized that the historical threats to monopoly power used to come from the political left, but that if they could use their monopoly power, their set of corporate power, to service the ends of the left itself, they could use it to effectively defang the threats that they used to face, because the right was ultimately bound by their orthodoxies that say the free market can do no wrong and really can't come back punitively on their own terms. So what Silicon Valley realized is that they could use their monopoly power to censor, or in their language, moderate content that certain parts of the left found offensive. But again, they didn't do it for free. They effectively expected that the new woke left would look the other way when it came to leaving their own monopoly power intact. And again, it worked masterfully for both sides. That's the story of this arranged marriage. Not a marriage of love, but more like mutual prostitution. And the net result of that act was the birth of a new Leviathan, a new force in modern American life, what I call the woke industrial complex, that is far more powerful than big government or big business alone, because together it can do what neither one of them can do on its own. And by the way, the rest of corporate America jumped right in to get in on the act. Coca-Cola issuing new statements about a voting law in Georgia that make it sound more like a super PAC than a soft drink manufacturer, teaching its employees internally in its trainings how to be less white, to say nothing of its own role and its product's own role in fueling the nationwide epidemic of diabetes and obesity, including, by the way, in the black community they profess to care so much about. Or Nike, condemning slavery 250 years ago to no end, while doing nothing to reduce their reliance on slave labor today to produce $250 sneakers that they sell to black kids in the inner city who can't afford to buy books for school. That is how this new game is played. And it is a new force that is far more powerful than what Thomas Hobbes envisioned 400 years ago. It is a new force that is far more powerful than what our own founding fathers envisioned 250 years ago. And it was distorted by a new force that supercharged it in the last few years in particular. And this is a new actor who actually showed up on the scene and turned this bilateral arranged marriage into a three-party affair. That's the Communist Party of China, actually. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. What I'm going to describe to you is actually available in plain sight, so long as we're willing to look. What the Communist Party of China has understood is that actually this new marriage between the new progressive left and big business in America presented a geopolitical opportunity of a generation that they have, in the last couple of years in particular, exploited and exploited serially. We'll see its exploitation on display in the coming weeks during the upcoming Winter Olympics in Beijing. The way it works is that they've recognized that they can attack us not from the outside, but from within by eroding our greatest geopolitical asset of all. That's not our nuclear arsenal. It is our moral standing on the global stage by effectively co-opting America's most venerated institutions to actually do their own bidding from within. So if you have any doubt about that, I'd encourage you to listen really carefully to what Xi Jinping has begun to say in recent years. As most of you are probably aware, China is in the midst of perpetrating one of the greatest human rights atrocities committed by a major nation since the Third Reich of Germany in what they're doing in the Xinjiang province to a population of religious minorities known as the Uyghurs, who are enslaved by the million plus, in concentration camps, subject to forced sterilization, communist indoctrination, and worse. And yet when Xi Jinping is now pressed by the EU or the UN, every time the first thing he says is that Black Lives Matter shows that the United States is no better. This is not an accident. Less than a year ago, his top diplomat came right here to the Alaska summit, right here to the United States, to the Alaska summit, and in his opening statement, criticized the United States slaughtering, that is his word, slaughtering of black Americans, and that he demanded that on behalf of China, he wanted to see the U.S. do better on human rights. This would be laughable if it weren't for the fact that our own corporations are actually lending implicit moral credibility to his claims. Take Disney, just a couple of years ago, says that it could not shoot a film in the state of Georgia if they passed the equivalent of a heartbeat bill, a new anti-abortion statute. Yet just last year goes to Mulan at literally ground zero of the Uyghur human rights crisis and films the entire movie there without compunction until the very end of the movie, where they finally muster up the courage in the credits to the film, you can see it today, to thank the local CCP authorities in Xinjiang for allowing them the privilege of filming there. That's Disney. The NBA is far worse, regularly decrying racial injustice here at home, continuing to expand into the Chinese market abroad. LeBron James, a top star from my home state in Ohio a few years ago, was the first person to come to China's public defense when Daryl Morey of the Houston Rockets tweeted, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." LeBron James ended up condemning what Daryl Morey had to say on behalf of Hong Kong and came to China's defense, as did Nike, as did the ownership of the Houston Rockets, as did other NBA stars. You might ask yourself why it is that these companies and their hired celebrities do it. The answer is actually quite simple. It's the same answer it came down to before, except here it's in an international context. It comes down to money. Because if you're an American corporation who wants to access the Chinese market, it turns out that China builds a great Chinese wall that prevents you from entering the Chinese market if you criticize the CCP. But they quietly roll out the red carpet if you criticize the United States. So that is how this new game is played. They actually turned a game that we started playing in the 1990s on its head. The game we started playing in the 1990s was the game of so-called democratic capitalism, where we thought we could use capitalism as a vector to spread democracy to places like China. We thought we could export Big Macs and Happy Meals, and somehow that was going to spread democracy. Well, they realized that they could actually turn that game on its head by saying that actually, instead of Big Macs and Happy Meals, we'll send back those Nike sneakers and Disney movies as Trojan horses to undermine the other side from within. We thought we could use our money to get them to be more like us. And what they recognized is that they could use their market power, their money, to get us to be more like them. Or one step even better, that they could use our money to get us to be more like them, which is effectively what they did from years of investment that began dating back to the 1990s. So these are flawed policies of the past, espoused both by Republicans and Democrats. And you know, by the way, who am I to blame anyone? I was in middle school at the time, or high, or elementary school at the time. That's the past. The question is where we go from here. Now, I think that in order to solve the problem, we have to be able to see it with clear eyes. I think that there are commercial interests and geopolitical interests that have amplified what was already the burning embers of a cultural struggle from within, but have really supercharged that with the fuel, the kerosene of cynical forces. Cynical forces on Wall Street, cynical forces in Silicon Valley, cynical forces on the global stage, principally originating in China. Questions: what we do about it. And I think the answer to that question, and at the heart of the answer to that question, rests what I view as really the defining North Star for the future of the conservative movement. I'll take you back to the 1980s, when we had the last major, in my opinion, redefinition of the North Star of the conservative movement, when Ronald Reagan rose to power in 1980. And when Ronald Reagan took his seat, he did what he needed to do to address the principal threats to liberty and prosperity in his era, which came from big government. He cut taxes, he slashed regulations, he did what he needed to do. That's why he's one of my heroes. But I will also remind this group, as I often do to audiences I speak to, of a favorite quote from a Republican, from my favorite Republican, actually, who spoke 160 years ago, not 40 years ago, when he reminded us that the dogmas of a quiet past are inadequate to address the stormy present. And what I say is that the dogmas of 1980 are inadequate to address the unique challenges that we now face in the year 2022. Back in 1980, big government may have been the single biggest threat to liberty and prosperity in this country. Today it is not. It is only half the story. It is a new hybrid of big government and big business that is far more powerful than either one alone. I actually am drawn to one of the founding creeds. I believe it is the founding creed of the Federalist Society itself, dating back to 1983, I believe. And if I'm going to get this right, I think what the founders of the Federalist Society said was a simple statement that sounds banal if you hear it without pausing, but there's real depth to it that meets the moment that we're in today. I think what it said, you guys may know better than I, is that the state exists to preserve liberty. Did I get that about right? The state exists to preserve liberty. See that embedded in that is a worldview that's different than a worldview that presumes that by definition, all threats to liberty originate from the state, versus a view of the state itself, whose own existence is predicated on preserving liberty itself. And I think that we live in one of those moments where we have to look ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves that just because the greatest threats to liberty came exclusively from big government 40 years ago, where does that leave us today in a moment where the threats to liberty may indeed be plural in nature? I think one of the issues where this comes to a head is in the area of big tech censorship, where 1980s wisdom would tell us that these are private companies who are free to decide what does and doesn't show up on their websites. As a one-time libertarian myself, I'm very sympathetic to that perspective, if those companies are actually behaving as private companies. But what we've seen in the last few years is that actually what's really happening is that these private companies are working hand in glove with the ascendant party in power, or the then ascendant party in power in the United States, to do through the back door what government could not directly do through the front door under the Constitution, namely to censor certain politically disfavored speech. So I think that continuing to wax eloquent about the free market is an insufficient set of solutions to address the merger of market power with political power. And I think what we need to recognize is that if it is state action in disguise, in the disguise of the market, if it's state action in disguise, then the Constitution still applies, and that those companies, when they're protected by the state, they ought to be bound by the Constitution, including the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Now, a policy solution that I personally favor is making, for example, Section 230 an opt-in statute to say that actually you can get federal governmental protection if that's necessary to spawn an industry, that you will give you this federal blanket of immunity that allows you to take down content whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. There I'm quoting directly Section 230(c)(2), which, by the way, was one of these unique statutes that was directly passed to allow a private company to do what government could not do directly. That is why it says whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. Well, I would say that, okay, if that's really necessary for an entire industry called the social media industry to exist, that's fine. Make it an opt-in statute. But if you opt-in, that comes with strings attached. And actually, what we're seeing today is a worse version than just the federal governmental protection. We're seeing direct coordination between the federal government and private companies to take down misinformation as defined by the party in power, to take down hate speech as defined by the party in power, but in a way that the party in power never could have done through the via the Constitution. So, look, I think there's a legal solution available to us. It's not one that I think we're going to see come to pass anytime soon, which is to say that a federal blanket of immunity comes with federal strings attached, much like a federal grant would. It's no different than giving $20 or $20,000 to every social media company to say that we're immunizing you from more than $20,000 worth of liability per year through a federal statute. That's got to come with strings attached. But even if that weren't going to come with strings attached, we already have existing legal doctrines in this country that allow us to make the case in court today that if it is state action in disguise, then the Constitution still applies, that the state should not be able to use private parties to do through the back door what they can't already accomplish through the front door. It's great case law. This is actually a case in Bantam Books, actually. I think it was in Pennsylvania, where there was a bookstore owner that wanted to sell a book that the local prosecutor didn't like very much. And so what the prosecutor said was, I'd like for you to take down that book. The bookstore owner says, no, I won't take down that book because it's my bookstore. To which the prosecutor responds with, after coming back a few days later, with a threat that said that actually he was going to prosecute the bookstore owner under some unrelated statute for some unrelated violation if he didn't take down the disfavored book, the disfavored speech. At which point the bookstore owner bent the knee and took down the book. Somebody wanted to buy the book, then actually ends up suing the bookstore owner on the theory of state action, which says that actually this was not the decision of a private bookseller to decide what book he was and wasn't selling. It was the decision of the state wrapped in the veneer of the decision of a private company. The Supreme Court held that, no, that doesn't work. The state can't use a private bookshop owner to do what the state couldn't do directly, found state action in the guise of the private company. There's another case, actually, relating to railroads. I forget the exact name of the case, where what the Supreme Court actually wanted to do, what the state wanted to do was to do what the Fourth Amendment had prohibited the state from being able to do, which was to randomly search people who were on trains for drugs. This was part of the war on drugs. We need to fight drugs at all costs. Let's search people on trains. Unfortunately, there's this pesky thing called the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States that prevents the state from being able to do that. So what did they do? They passed a statute that immunized the railroads from any liability to say that, hey, we, the state, aren't going to conduct these random searches and seizures, but you, the railroads, are free to do it. In fact, we, the federal government, are going to pass a law that says that if you do get sued in state court, you have a special blanket of immunity that prevents you from being able, I think this is Hansen is the case, you actually would be free to do it without any liability in state court if an employee or a passenger wants to sue you, to which the Supreme Court again found that, no, that doesn't fly. If government is going to immunize a private party from liability to be able to induce that private party to do what the government couldn't do directly, then again, it was still state action in disguise. There's another case that actually laid out what the standards are for finding state action in the guise of a private company. It was either the use of threats or the use of inducements or the use of willful participation in a joint activity, coordination between the state and the government. The irony is what we see in the case of big tech censorship isn't one of those three conditions. It isn't two of those three conditions. It's all three of those conditions. Threats from legislators on Capitol Hill to say that if you don't tack down hate speech and misinformation, as we, the party in power, define it, then we're going to come after you. We're going to regulate you. We're going to break you up. You've heard this from Democratic lawmakers over the course of the last 2 years. By the way, combined with the carrot, the cloak of Section 230 immunity liability, liability shielding, which says that actually if you take down speech that's otherwise constitutionally protected, even under state anti-discrimination laws, including political anti-discrimination laws, you can't be sued in state court. Oh, and by the way, we're going to brag about it now in the front door of a White House press conference. This is no longer a conspiracy theory. This is something that the White House boasts about, the way in which they're able to coordinate with Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms to be able to take down hate speech and misinformation as one way of fighting the pandemic or fighting hate speech or whatever the favored social agenda of the day may be. I think those are the kinds of solutions that we need to wake up to in a moment where actually the threat to liberty didn't directly come from the state, but was intermediated through the actions of a private company, but in ways that the classical libertarian agenda falls short of actually seeing with clarity. So I generally favor this pair of either policy solutions or legal solutions under existing law, which don't rely on the existence of policy solutions. And I think that we might see the same thing with respect to discrimination in the offline world today, too, where the internet is far from the only frontier where we've seen abuses and threats to liberty that we ought to respond to. In the offline world, we're actually beginning to see a wave of firings in the workplace that have created a cultural threat to actual free speech and expression, where people have been fired for attending the wrong political rally, wearing the hat of the disfavored presidential candidate to work, and so forth. And again, conventional 1980s wisdom would tell us that these are private businesses that should be free to decide who does and doesn't get to work there, or who does and doesn't get to be their customer. I'd say that I'm pretty sympathetic to that, as long as we apply that standard evenly. But here's the thing. We also have, at the same time, anti-discrimination statutes at the federal level that say that you cannot discriminate against somebody under the civil rights statutes on account of their race or their sex or their national origin or their religion, or as sex was construed last year or a year and a half ago under Bostock, on base of their sexual orientation. But somehow, you are free to discriminate on account of their political beliefs. Well, my own view is that I might be happy living in a world where we had no protected classes in the first place, and we really let the market sort these things out, because if all of these businesses over here want to do a silly thing by firing great employees of a certain political persuasion or a certain race or a certain religion or whatever, that would create an opportunity for a different business over here that could hire them instead, and the market could be able to work these things out. But that's not the world we live in today. And no libertarian today, as much as they might oppose adding further protected categories like political belief to our civil rights statutes on account of not burdening businesses with one more regulatory constraint, has actually taken up, or had the spine to take up, the original battle of actually rolling back the existence of protected categories in the first place. And here's a dirty little secret from having lived in corporate America myself. The existence of those protected categories are actually part of what created the very conditions for the kind of political discrimination that we see in the workplace today. Because actually, if you take protected categories like race and gender and sexual orientation and religion and read that through the lens of a Griggs versus Duke power, which actually reads into the law findings of discrimination on the basis of disparate impact, that's where you get human resources bureaucracies, what I call the deep corporate apparatus, that administers those civil rights statutes through reviving the new dogma of anti-racism. Ibram Kendi, who I quoted earlier, the remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. That creates the very conditions for the rampant political discrimination that we see today while leaving political discrimination unprotected. So the way I look at it is, if you can't fire somebody on account of their race or their gender or their sexual orientation or their religion, then you shouldn't be able to fire somebody or deplatform somebody on account of their political beliefs either. That if you can't fire somebody or deplatform somebody because they're black or gay or Muslim or white or Christian or Jewish or Hindu or whatever, then you should not be able to fire or deplatform somebody just because they're an outspoken conservative or an outspoken liberal, for that matter, either. And the thing is, this is no longer an academic issue. It is happening directly or indirectly every day in this country. If it can happen to the 45th president of the United States, whoever he was, it can happen to anybody in the country. Now, again, I don't hold out any hope that in the near term we're going to see political belief added to the U.S. civil rights statutes. I think it might be more plausible to add it to state-level protected categories. However, even without legislative action, there's actually available remedies, I think, under existing case law here, too, as there was in the case of state action in the guise of big tech enterprises. Here, I think that, actually, I look to the civil rights statutes and the prohibition of discrimination on the basis of religion. Now, most people understand, I'm sure most of you do too, that the prohibition on discrimination on religion prevents you from firing an employee on account of his or her religious beliefs. But the flip side is also true. Actually, it also means, under longstanding case law, that an employer cannot force its religion down the throats of that employee. The test is actually can't force an employee to bow down to the religion of the employer. Well, actually, that raises the question of whether the new orthodoxies that pervade our private sector actually meet the Supreme Court's test for what counts as a religion. And as I've argued in my book and in other forums, there's little doubt that the modern woke orthodoxy meets that standard in spades. There are certain words you can't say, clothes you can't wear, apologies you must recite, excommunication procedures that must be initiated. It is not a worldview on a single matter, but a comprehensive set of worldviews that are closely and sincerely held. If creativity, a religion that I don't subscribe to, which professes white supremacy as its core tenet, counts as a religion, as it does under Supreme Court case law in a case called Peterson, then surely anti-white supremacy, which is exactly what wokeness professes to be on its own terms, ought to count too. I mean, and I think it meets the Supreme Court's tests in spades. Even secular humanism counts as a religion under Supreme Court standards for what's protected under civil rights statutes. Surely the new postmodern religion of wokeness and critical theorism counts as well. So these are, I think, the unique pair of solutions that I think we can look to as legal minds, both from a public policy perspective as well as from a legal perspective, a litigation perspective even, under existing statutes. But I think that one of the things I've come to be, you know, I think increasingly concerned about is the over-inclusive application of any of those solutions. Any policy is going to have unintended consequences. It was passed to meet one set of challenges. It's going to remain on the books, and 30 years from now is going to have some set of unintended consequences. Broadening the scope of how we read a potentially, if we're to call it for what it is, a potentially judicially activist approach to read into the religion clause of the civil rights statutes more than was actually intended, certainly when those statutes were passed. That, too, will have unintended consequence in the future, which has caused me to rededicate some of my own efforts, and really where I'm focusing my future efforts personally, to not driving the kinds of cultural changes we care about driving exclusively through the front door of either the law or the courtrooms, but actually to do it through the front door of the market instead. And here I think it's something that in some ways makes deep sense to me. In other ways, it's a problem that I struggle with. The way it makes deep sense is that actually if the cultural threats we face arose not from necessarily directly from the state, but from a change in our fundamental underlying culture and the market institutions that perpetuate that culture, then surely there's a good reason to believe that the most impactful solutions would start there too. Here's the part I struggled with, though, is that I also don't want to see the emergence of two economies in our country, to say that there is an opportunity to create an alternative version of an Airbnb or a Nike or a BlackRock or a JP Morgan Chase or an American Express or a Twitter or a Facebook or whatever. I believe that opportunity exists, or YouTube. I believe that many people have begun to take the first steps in that journey with varying degrees of success. But I think none of us should want to see the emergence of actually two perpetual parallel economies, because history would teach us that is the path to an actual civil war in a country. We've seen that before. And we lose the sanctity of a private sector that should bring us together, irrespective of whether we're black or white, whether we're Democrat or Republican, whether we're gay or straight. We can all engage in an economy together and provide the foundations for actual solidarity as a people. We lose that with two economies. That being said, I also think we're not starting from neutral territory, though. And what I'd like to see is brave entrepreneurs and brave investors and brave market participants step up to take an actual universalist approach that captures an opportunity that I believe is staring us in the face. It's a commercial opportunity. I think it might be one of the biggest commercial opportunities of our moment, staring us in the face of 100 plus million Americans today. I think the number is actually closer to 150 or 200 million Americans today, but at least 100 million who are actually quietly, deeply disaffected from the places they work, from the places they shop, from the places they invest, from the places they bank, as big business in America has embraced a neo-progressive orthodoxy that they find personally repugnant. But the irony is, actually, from a commercial perspective, these are also some of the same Americans that, I can tell you as a businessman myself, these are some of the best customers of any business. They tend to be hard workers, net savers, good credit risks, good insurance risks on balance. Yet these are exactly the very customers across the country who the rest of corporate America has abandoned, in some cases alienated, in some cases outright excluded, due to this unusual moment of cultural dislocation. And I think there's an opportunity to go after these customers, perhaps with a right-wing message, to say that actually, if corporate America's gone left, the new corporate America's going to go right. And I think that there could be a successful commercial opportunity available for some. I don't know that that's going to take the country in a great direction. But I also think there's an even, I think, better commercial opportunity, but I think, I also believe, better opportunity culturally for the country to go after that same customer base with a purposefully universalist message that isn't right-wing or left-wing, but revives certain basic ideas that are so basic that we would have found them to be banal 30 years ago, but are powerful in a moment where a new orthodoxy has ultimately pervaded our culture. Basic ideas like the idea that we are one nation, that the content of your character trumps the color of your skin, that diversity of thought is more important than diversity of appearance, that we're a nation built on equal opportunity, not equal results, that capitalism is the best system known to mankind to lift people up from poverty, and that we're not going to apologize for it as an allegedly racist system, that if we have to choose between pursuing diversity and excellence or pursuing anything else and excellence, that we will choose excellence every time and we will not apologize for it. Those are our values, fundamental American values, the values of what I call the nascent excellence economy, an affirmative alternative to the ESG and DEI orthodoxies that pervade corporate America today. I think not only is there a commercial opportunity, but an opportunity to hopefully have the impact on BlackRock and Nike and Airbnb and Unilever and P&G and United Airlines and American Airlines and everyone in between to wake up by hitting them where it hurts most on their bottom line by stealing customers by the millions, to wake up, I hope, 5 years from now, and I hope you mark my words and my prediction comes true, that they will say that actually our approach to diversity and inclusion over the last few years might not have been as diverse and inclusive as we thought it was going to be, and thereby restore an equilibrium to our culture, starting with the market first, in a way that, yes, has its own risks. If it's done in the wrong way, inelegantly, it may actually contribute to the existing fissures. That's no doubt a risk, but I think is a lower risk than the risks associated with taking an over-inclusive, unintended consequence of policy legal approach that may be necessary for the right thinkers in the Republican Party or the conservative movement to adopt as the right policy measures, but may miss the mark by half by actually failing to recognize that the right answer may actually begin outside of rooms like this one and inside rooms that begin in our living room when we use our credit card to make a given purchasing decision. So that's the opportunity that I actually see, that I'd like to see emerge further to the forefront of conversations like the ones we're having today in organizations like the Federalist Society, in other parts of the conservative movement that are committed to liberty and prosperity and to the promise of free markets, to be able to not forget that that vehicle, too, can actually be one of the vehicles through which we can deliver positive solutions. And one of the things I'm doing is actually I've given a lot of thought to the last year and a half of how to have that impact most effectively. Wade running for office, Wade, you know, starting a nonprofit centered on reviving some of those shared American ideals, but ultimately decided that actually one of the things that we were missing in our movement was actually combining the heft of that vision with the heft of actual power and relevance in the marketplace that, if wielded carefully, could actually swing the pendulum back in ways that were more effective than any public policy could catalyze in its own right. So with that, and before I get to closing, and I would like to take some comments, I also want to recognize that even those market solutions, I think, would also be incomplete in their own right in getting us to the right end state. This is a multi-front battle, and I think there is no single silver bullet. And we have to recognize that the most important solutions to our culture may actually start with education and looking towards the next generation beyond public policy or beyond the market alone. And I'll be the first person to recognize that we are a nation that no longer teaches our kids to be proud of our country, but rather to be ashamed of our history. Faith is on the decline. Patriotism has nearly disappeared. Hard work and family along with it. We're a nation that's built of a new generation, my generation included, that's actually really hungry for a sense of purpose, hungry for a cause, hungry for meaning and identity that we have failed to fill with the kinds of things that used to fill that hunger for purpose and identity, concepts like faith and patriotism and hard work. As those have disappeared, we now have a deep black hole left in its wake. And I think that it's when you have a vacuum that runs that deep that darker philosophies like postmodernism and wokeism begin to fill that void. And the thing that we're going to need to do is to fill that hole with something far more rich and far more meaningful than what the postmodern dogma offers. We've effectively taught a new generation of Americans that you have a moral hunger, and the way to satisfy that hunger is to go to Ben and Jerry's and order a cup of ice cream with a cup of morality on the side, without recognizing that we can only fill that moral hunger with a more substantial fare. And I think that too is the other prong of the, I think, an opportunity for not just the conservative movement, but a new national movement that aims to answer that question of not just what it means to be a conservative, but what it means to be an American in the year 2022. I think we lack a good answer to that question. And I think our lack of an answer to that question is actually the black hole at the center of our nation's soul. And that one of the things that we ought to do in our schools and in our culture is to ask that question more often. To ask ourselves to remind ourselves of what were those ideas that 250 years ago brought together an otherwise divided polyglot group of people, religiously divided and otherwise, together behind a shared vision of what a nation could be. Not just a place, but a vision for what that place could be. And at the top of that list of ideals was actually the very vision for the excellence economy that I outlined earlier too, the American dream. The idea that no matter who you are or where you came from or what language your parents spoke, you can achieve anything you ever want in this country with your own hard work, your own commitment, your own dedication, and by the way, have the freedom to speak your mind at every step of the way. That is the American dream. And I think that is what we're going to need to revive in every aspect of our culture, driven not just by law and policy, but by the market and education too, to revive a shared identity that dilutes the postmodern poison to irrelevance. So with that, I'll thank you for your time, and I'll look forward to taking some questions from all of you, and I'll ask for your help in joining me in that movement, not just in the legal sphere, but equally importantly, in the sphere of the market as well. Thank you.
In your book, Woke Inc., you suggest one idea is to have mandatory public service for high school students during the summers. I was curious why you wouldn't want to emulate the other countries you mentioned that have a public service requirement by requiring 1 or 2 years after high school.
Yeah, sure. So I will be the first person to say that a lot of the ideas that I offer in Woke Inc. Were not offered as the thought-out planks of a presidential platform, but as provocations for conversations that I think we ought to be having in thinking outside of a constrained box in a conservative movement that I think we've found ourselves increasingly shackled by, at least orthodoxies that we inherited 30, 40 years ago. So the reason, to answer your question narrowly, why I do favor weaving civic service into primary education, but also only favor it insofar as it's limited to private education rather than afterwards, is that we don't, even a committed libertarian, and I have to admit that I have some of those strains still left in me, still recognizes that children aren't fully formed agents and aren't fully formed citizens. And the rules of the road that might apply to the rest of us just don't, in any state of the world, apply to kids who aren't yet fully formed agents to which a libertarian worldview can apply. I think that there's room for debate about whether we should adopt an Israeli-style system of 2 years of compulsory service after you've completed high school. But I think I, almost for myself, tactically sidestepped all of the trade-offs and the impingement on liberty of a fully formed adult in their capacity as a citizen versus as a free agent in the country in which they are a citizen. We avoid those set of questions by actually weaving it into education starting from a young age, where we recognize that no kid was actually subject to their own volition to decide what they wanted to do. We have mandatory education in this country already. Let's weave civic education, and as a part of civic education, even civic service into education, where I, by the way, think that's going to have a greater impact on the way that a new generation views their nation, too. I personally think that you are less likely to value something that you inherit. You are more likely to value something that you have a stake in building, whether that's a business, whether that's a country. I think the same principle applies. And I think that children who have a greater stake in having built our country will value the country more that they're left with on the other side of it. So for both of those reasons, that's why I favor a policy direction around any conversation around mandatory civic education or civic service being both confined to and concentrated in the realm of primary education. Thank you for that.
And then, how do you see cryptocurrencies and their role in this alternative economy about which you spoke?
Yeah, so I've been thinking a lot about what's going on in the world of cryptocurrency and blockchain. I think that a lot of my friends in Silicon Valley fall into a trap that I want to be careful not to fall into, which is to conflate fundamental cultural issues with technocratic ones instead. And the reason I think I see it from a lot of my peers in Silicon Valley is that they kind of agree with most of what I said. Not even kind of. The ones I have in mind agree with most of what I said, but don't really feel like waging that battle. And so sort of conflate those issues with these seemingly technical issues that actually the problem is we have this centralized currency system that the Fed can manipulate, and we need an independent arbiter of value, and the backstop and the full faith and credit of the United States is just BS, and we need something else, and the answer to social media is to decentralize everything, that Facebook and Twitter are centralized platforms. We need to turn social media into an email-like system where it's decentralized so no single person can control it. And here's where I am on that. I agree with most of those things. I think that they're mostly cop-outs to avoid discussing the heart of what are actually culturally challenging, fraught issues that you can't sidestep by building some technology layer that addresses a problem whose origins rest in a culture that are far simpler. I mean, building a cryptocurrency system and a new blockchain system, that's really complicated in that it's not simple, whereas the cultural issues I'm talking about are actually really simple, but they're hard in that they're not easy. And I actually think that building a new decentralized blockchain system is complicated, but easy. Addressing our culture is really simple in that it's not complex, but it is hard in that it's not easy. And what I see a lot of my friends in Silicon Valley doing is gravitating to complexity as a way of avoiding that which is actually hard. And the hard work of addressing our culture is something that I think we all, whether we're in Silicon Valley or here in Missouri, ought to look at straight. First by starting by looking in the mirror, actually, and asking ourselves what role we play in contributing to that culture, but then to address the cultural issues head on rather than effectively changing the subject.
Hey, thanks so much for being here. Love the book. The CCP stuff hit a chord with me because of what I see in my legal practice, which is predominantly international IP litigation. Most of my clients have had their IP stolen by CCP-affiliated Chinese competitors. You can imagine, you know, sort of the fact patterns that we see. And one of the disheartening things is the administrative agency where these types of disputes are heard, they don't feel in their gut any loyalty, in my opinion, to American companies. They're sort of global citizen type technocrats.
Yep.
And so a U.S. company that's built a business and had all of that stolen by a Chinese competitor has to spend an insane amount of money to try to get any remedy. And the Chinese competitor can basically take advantage of our legal system.
Which our own administrative state, you're saying, the actors
in there. Our own administrative state, yeah. Kind of seems to, in the course of these cases, serve the interests of the CCP more than it serves the interests of American companies. So I wanted to comment on that and then ask you a question also about universities, which, as you know, is kind of part of this woke apparatus. And they bring in tons of foreign students, which in theory I'm okay with, but a lot of them are effectively sent sort of on behalf of the CCP or maybe have some sort of goal where they're going to take the technology back there. Just what I've seen in my practice, a lot of the IP espionage or thievery comes from students who are at our prestigious American universities and then go home and compete with American companies. So how does the university and administrative state play into the CCP issues that you touched upon? Thanks.
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, I think that we have a... I think it requires viewing the cultural challenges we face through a different prism than the classical, canonical, state-based threat to liberty versus individual need for liberty axis that we as conservatives, I think, are sometimes want to do in a limiting way. So here, I think the different prism through which I would answer that question is really the rise of a new managerial class in our country and even transnationally that have really sucked the life, the ethos, out of every institution that they're entrusted with running one at a time, be that in our private sector, in the market, be that in our academic sector, in the university, or be that even in our government, where you have agencies whose purview has expanded far beyond the initial narrowly scoped ethos of each of those institutions. And it's even borne out further by the fact that it's actually often the same members of the same managerial class who miscibly permeate boundaries that otherwise separate those different institutions from one another. It's the same people who become ambassadors, who then become investment bankers, who then get an associate deanship or an associate professorship at the very academic institutions you're talking about. I think that's the axis through which we also need to see the real threats to liberty that aren't, strictly speaking, intermediated through the state. The state's included in that. But it's a new managerial layer that the way I think about it is more aligned with biology. It's more like a cancer that metastasizes from one organ to another. And we can't look at the problem through the prism of just one of those organs, but through all of the organs that can actually be affected by a cancer that wasn't organ specific in the first place. And I think that China has co-opted that managerial class, including through commercial interests at the level of individuals, as well as through more concerted efforts of downright placing members of that managerial class into the place where they rest today, to be able to co-opt that horizontal infection of institutions, both in the private, public, and educational sectors at once, to advance geopolitical aims in ways that neither of our political parties is really set up to see, because they're playing tug of war on a very different axis, while actually both parties house many members of that very managerial class that represents the source of that infection. So in a certain sense, the party apparatuses themselves are like organs that have also been infected by that metastasizing cancer. Where does that leave us by way of solutions? I think that, again, I more put this in the category currently of intellectual provocation than actual policy prescription, though I'm getting pretty close to the latter on some of these, is that, look, I think that we're going to have to, at some point as a country, embrace our willingness to endure short-term pain for long-run geopolitical gain as it pertains to China. I think it is currently unforgivable that we are underwriting we're effectively subsidizing the credibility of the CCP and the Xi regime by participating in the Winter Olympics that our athletes will be participating in the coming weeks. To the contrary, I think that we might want to think about a moment where we go in the other direction to do the crazy. What I'm about to say, by any commercial standard, is a crazy thing to say, but we live in a crazy moment that may actually have even crazier geopolitical consequences if we fail to be bold today, which is to say that actually, you know what, tomorrow, and I would be comfortable, we could debate whether this could be done by executive order or would require legislative backstop. Tomorrow, no company that does business in the United States can simultaneously do business in China until certain conditions are met by the CCP, including but not limited to total transparency to the origin of this pandemic, total transparency with respect to the intellectual property and theft, and total transparency with respect to who is a direct or indirect agent of that regime in the managerial class spanning multiple institutions here. Until then, it's done. We're putting a hold on it, and that's it. And that will no doubt cause a shock and awe to the market for the worse. It will no doubt have an impact on many U.S. businesses that will have a short-term hit to their profits. But at some point, the question we have to ask ourselves is, are we really going to remain on the path where every American is a Uyghur 300 years from now, according to the Chinese vision, or do we take a step in the short run to be able to endure some level of short-run pain to be able to harvest the long-run geopolitical gain that we're going to have to recapture if we're ultimately going to be on the winning side of the defining great power struggle of our time? I also think, as it pertains to our managerial class, I think that where most Republican presidents have failed, and certainly Democratic ones even more so, have been to actually run the government that they were elected to run. Even Donald Trump, in my opinion, nobody asked me for my opinion on this, but I'll offer it anyway because it relates to your question. I think his principal failure was that he actually failed to run the government that he was elected to run. He would, so much so that he would complain about it in press conferences from the White House press briefing room, that Anthony Fauci or the FBI or whatever, people who were supposed to report to him, supposedly, weren't doing the things that he wanted them to do, yet rather than firing them, was left to really complain to the media about it, which of course turned the media itself into a fifth branch of government that ultimately actually was in on the act. I think that whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, I think that you're going to need candidates who step up with a willingness to say that we're not going to reform these agencies, because they can't be reformed. The agenda is going to be that we're going to actually shut them down. And I don't care what the short-term consequences of shutting them down are actually going to be. If the FBI won't vet your nominees as the president of the United States, then the answer isn't to complain about it. It probably isn't even to fire the guy who you appointed to run the FBI, because that guy doesn't run it either. It's to shut it down, actually. Is there going to be a short-term consequence from shutting down the NIH and the FBI and the SEC and the FTC and the FDA? You know, probably. I think that there will be adverse, path-dependent short-term consequences. But I think that if you're serious about addressing the managerial cancer, you can't treat one metastasis of that cancer with a Band-Aid. You have to go in with surgical therapy and then radiation to follow to get rid of the original tumor. And I think that that's something that we have yet to have mustered the political willingness to actually do. And I think that that will be the defining question for the future of a conservative movement, of whether it actually has it in its bones to be able to do the thing that you're going to need to do to actually restore a real democracy, which is one where the people we elect to run the government are actually the ones who run the government, which certainly is not the state of affairs that obtains today. Amy? You want to go to a mic? Or I can repeat it. I'll repeat it.
Okay, this works. So why not then a parallel economy, a national divorce, your complex technical solutions that allow people to escape all the unjust force that's being levied on them, I see all of those solutions as an analogy to what you're saying with respect to China. We say, we're not going to do business with you unless and until you treat us properly on our terms. Why can't we do that, you know, within our society?
Yeah, look, I personally care about still having a nation left at the end of it. And I think that it depends on what your defining goal and North Star is. I think if it is simply a case for individual flourishing as a free human being in the society we occupy, that there's a conversation to be had about whether two parallel economies and societies in the United States, which is mostly the direction we're heading in already today, isn't an end state that we shouldn't, that we should be open to. I guess for me, America isn't just one of those things, though. It isn't just the story of the rugged individual and the American dream and the individualist notion of each of us being able to achieve whatever we want to achieve and our own dreams and our own prosperity. Surely, as Americans, every one of us harbors those urges and impulses and dreams for ourselves. But I also think that's just half the story. I also think America is the other thing, too, a desire to be part of a whole that is greater than the sum of its parts, unity that brings together the disparate pieces that underlie it. I mean, 1776 wasn't just the year of the wealth of nations. It was also the year of the Declaration of Independence. And I think that the paradox at the heart of our American identity is that we're both of those things. We're individuals and we're a collective. We're not one of those things. We're both of those things. And I worry about the way in which resorting to the exclusive parallelization of the economy and then the culture sacrifices one of those things by making individual choice and self-actualization a choice at the expense of the greater whole that America represents too, as expressed through our democracy and our shared constitutional culture. So that's why I don't want to see things play out that way. But I'm halfway with you, Amy. I think that the solution has to be, I think, using the market to restore that culture back and to bring back participants in that market, some of whom have unwittingly veered too far in the direction of creating two parallel economies without recognizing the damage they've done.
So I see that right now it's if the search for a parallel economy or some sort of side-by-side solution is just a recognition that there's a whole faction of our society today that has abandoned the original American ideal. So it's not rugged individualism where you're just doing it by yourself at the expense. It's that there's a group of people who want to be part of the type of society that you are discussing, but that there's a lot of people who are, by their actions at least, and also often their words, are saying that they don't. And let's just recognize that we are two different societies with different sets of values and allow people to make the choice, you know, voluntarily participating in the one that is actually consistent with the American ideal.
Yeah, so I think they're just descriptively, I would disagree with you that we actually are those two societies. I think that It sort of feels like a Platonic or Plato style shadow in the cave. That's what the shadow version of it looks like today. But it's a product of cynical exploitation of divisions that actually didn't cross the Rubicon of actually representing a fundamentally different culture, but a culture that was fraught with questions that we hadn't yet sorted out, on questions of identity and who we are as a people, that were cynically exploited by a combination of commercial interests and geopolitical interests that have created the illusion of actually creating two cultures that were as separable as oil from water. And I think that part of why I like the parallel economy, not as a destination, but as a stop along the way, is that it exploits those cynical motivations by hitting them where it hurts most, by ultimately actually revealing, as it turns out, the profitable opportunity for going directly after the 150 million Americans who are hungry for that alternative. I predict that doing that in the right way will actually have the effect of revealing that we actually were one nation at the end of it, and the cynical forces that caused us to appear to be as divided as we were on two sides of a cultural Mississippi was actually just an illusion created by, I think, cynical exploitation from the outside, half of which was commercial interests within the United States, and the other half of which were commercial interests originating from places in China. So I'm with you, hoping for the same.
We're going to have to stop it there. The representatives want their hats back, but let's
thank you.
Thank you so much for your talk.